ISKCON founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Natapati Vaishnavinda ki jai, Namacharya Srila Haridas Thakur ki jai, Prem Shikaho Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Dvaita Gadadhar Shri Vasadi Gora Bhaktivinda ki jai, Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gogopinath Shyamakunda Radha Kunda Gidi Govardhana ki jai, Vrindavan Dhamma ki jai, Mathura Dhamma ki jai, Navadvip Mayapur Dhamma ki jai, Jagannath Puri Dhamma ki jai, Gangamai Jamuna Devi ki jai, Bhakti Devi ki jai, Tulsi Maharani ki jai, Samaveta Bhakti Vrinda ki jai, Gaur Premanande. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Vasaya Vidalation Mati Bhakti Vinata Swami Niti Namane Namaste Saraswati Deve Gaurvani Pachani Nivisesa Sinimani Paskatyade Satarni Mande Hum Shri Guru Shri Utah Padakamalam Shri Guru and Vaishnavam Stan Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Bitham Sam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Padichana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lavita Shri Vishakam Bitham Stan Panchapapa Chuvistaki Pisanamantap Titanam Pavane Vajnavan. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. May 4th, 2015, in Potomac, Maryland, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 89, Text 5. Chapter Krishna Arjuna Retrieve a Brahmana's Sons is the title of the chapter, but we're reading about Bhrigu Muni's testing of the three principal guna avatars. Tata Kailasam Agamat. Satam Devo Maheshwaraha Pari Rabdum Samareba Utaya Brataram Muda. If anybody has the verse, they can check. Tata Kailasam Agamat Satam Devo Maheshwara. Hari Rabdum Samarebda Udaya Bhartaram Muda Tataha, then, Kailasam, to Mount Kailasa, Agamat, went, Saha, he, Bhrigu, Tam, him, Devaha Maha Ishwaraha, Lord Shiva, Parirabdham, to embrace, Samarebe, attempted, Uttaya, standing up, Brataram, his brother, Muda, with pleasure. Translation. Bhrigu then went to Mount Kailasha. There Lord Shiva stood up and happily came forward to embrace his brother. Purport. In the Vedic civilization, it is considered very important to properly greet one's family members, especially when one has not seen them for a long time. A worthy son should show respect to his father. A younger brother should honor his older brother. And the older brother should show affection to his younger brother in turn. Tata Kailasam Agamat Satam Devo Maheshwara parirabdham samareba utaya brataram muda. Bhrigu then went to Mount Kailasa. There Lord Shiva stood up and happily came forward to embrace his brother. So we may wonder, what is the relevance of this sort of etiquette in our modern society? You know, we see sort of two trends. One is, okay, we've got to have etiquette. We've got to have etiquette. It's really important. And people teaching courses in etiquette. And then on the other hand, we have people who say, oh, it's really not important. This is for a different culture, a different time and place. I mean, even in our modern world, the cultural etiquette varies widely. You know, what's considered proper respect. Because in every culture, there's a sense of authority and community. And sociologists have examined that there's, are there any moral principles that are universal? And they found there are five universal moral principles, regardless of the culture: purity, authority, fairness, community, and harm. So this is...
Can you say those again?
Yeah, you can remember patch and change the T into an F. And then you'll get authority, fairness. You have to change the T into an F. Community and harm. And harm.
Harmony.
Harm. Don't harm anyone.
Oh. Okay.
That harm is bad. So now, of course, in different societies, they may emphasize one of these over another. So fairness may be emphasized over community or over authority, but all five of these operate in any society. But the way they operate is going to be quite different from one society to another. Just like in every society, killing a police officer is more serious than killing an ordinary citizen. And killing your parents is more serious than killing somebody else. So some respect for authority. And then community, the concept of loyalty. In most countries of the world, treason is a capital offense. You know, it's punishable by death or by lifetime imprisonment. And to do something against your community is very serious. But still, the nuances of how this plays out varies widely. And just like in English, we have only one word for you. I think in Korean they have 15 words. Also Indonesian, they have many words for you. In Hindi, they have at least two, right? Correct? At least two words for you. Even in French, there's two words for you, depending on your relationship. And by the way, language changes things. So many years ago, there was a major Korean airline that had a very high accident rate. And they found out this accidents were mostly occurring when the pilot was flying and the co-pilot noticed a problem. Because in their society, the co-pilot really couldn't just say to the pilot, hey, buddy, there's a problem. It would be a violation of etiquette. And the way they solved this problem was by enforcing that all the pilots and the co-pilots had to speak English to each other. And they created a different culture, just even with language. So again, we may look at these systems of etiquette. You haven't seen your family member for a long time. Like Krishna goes and sees the Pandavas. Right? And Maharaj Yudhisthira is his elder, and Arjuna and Bhimasena are same age, and Nakula and Sahadeva are younger. And so they deal with each other very differently. The younger brothers, they touch his feet. Krishna touches Yudhisthira's feet. He embraces Bhima and Arjuna. And we may think, well, is this really relevant to our culture? You know, can you really apply this all over the world? You know, I give the example many times that, you know, in America, if you're eating at somebody's house, you're a guest at somebody's house, they don't just put food on your plate that you haven't asked for. It just doesn't happen in America. You know, they'll ask you, would you like seconds? And you can, and if you say no, they don't give you any. In fact, generally in America, everybody eats at the same table. The hosts and the guests eat at the same table. Mm-hmm. And unless they have servants, nobody is serving. The serving bowls are in the middle of the table, and everybody serves themselves. Whereas when you go to India, if you are invited to somebody's house, at least the wife, and usually the wife and the husband, will not eat with you. They'll eat later, and they will be there to serve you. Right? And they will serve you whether you've asked for something or not. know. And even if you say you don't want something, they'll still put it on your plate. And it's interesting because when people go from one culture to another, they think that there's disrespect. But actually, there's a universal principle of respect. It's just being shown differently. Hari Vilas Prabhu is from Armenia, and he tells the story that when his parents came to America, one of their neighbors invited them over for dinner. So they came over for dinner, and they were sitting on the couch. And the hosts said, "So, dinner's ready?" And they said, no, we're not hungry. And the host said, no, it's ready. It's time to eat, you know. No, it's okay. We don't want any of that. "Are you sure?" Yeah, we're sure. So the host sat down, and they ate in front of their guests. And he said, then his family went back home, and they were furious at how they had been disrespected. You know, so it's quite interesting. You know, yes?
But he was invited to dinner at their house. Why would he say, "I'm not hungry," when the host had invited him to dinner?
Because
that was a type of disrespect as
well. Well, that's type of disrespect in America. But in many cultures, you're supposed to say no when you mean yes.
You ask repeatedly.
Ramananda
Prabhu tells the same story with Mahindra Yugala Rasa. Her mother was at their house, and she did the same thing. He asked her if
you
wanted.
You had to ask. You have to insist and insist and insist.
Oh, you must take. You must take.
Exactly. Exactly.
No. Very good.
Like in Japan, you're supposed to say no at least 3 times. You know, and if someone please come to my house for dinner. No, I'm busy. I can't come. If someone says that in America, you say, okay, well, maybe another time.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah? But in Japan, you're supposed to ask again. Please come to my house. No, No, you must come. You must come. I insist. No. At least 3 times I have to say no. I insist. All right, but only some rice and soy sauce. But then, of course, they'll cook a huge feast. So the idea of etiquette is very different. You know, in some cultures, the guest is not supposed to impose on the host. And in other cultures, the host is not supposed to impose on the guest. You know, and I find it very interesting as I'm constantly moving from one culture to another, where the etiquette can be opposite, completely opposite. So in one culture, you show respect by not pushing anything on your guest. In another culture, you show respect by pushing on your guest. So both cultures are trying to show respect, but they're showing it in vastly different ways. And this becomes an issue in our international society for Krishna consciousness. And I believe it's one of the biggest issues that we face in our international society for Krishna consciousness, unless you're in a temple where everybody is from that particular culture. And of course, in America, we even have subcultures, because America is a very international country. You know, there's some parts of the country where it's very homogeneous, but in most places, even Americans, even people who were born and raised in America, have different subcultures. So the subculture, say, in, you know, a little town in the Appalachian Mountains is very different than the subculture in San Francisco, or than the subculture in New York, or the subculture in L.A., or in Las Vegas. And, you know, there's different ways of behaving. And these things are ingrained in us from a very, very young age, and they're ingrained in us pretty much unconsciously. So we simply say, oh, that person is being rude. That person is being rude. That person is being disrespectful. When probably they are being respectful, but according to a different cultural standard. So this is a major, major question, which I don't believe has been resolved at all, what to speak of, even properly addressed in our Hare Krishna movement. Are we suggesting that in our ISKCON temples we have one cultural standard and that we train everybody in only one cultural standard? Do we try to destroy or supplant the cultural norms of wherever our temple is situated? You know, are these particular ways of showing etiquette that are taught in the scriptures, is this something that we should institute? And again, I don't think that we've even properly addressed it. Now, when we institute, if we tried, I'm not sure if we could even do it, especially since we're having a constant influx of new people in all of our centers. That's at least our aim. But could we supplant local culture with the kind of culture we read about in the Bhagavatam. I don't know if we could. I really don't know if we could, because the culture we're raised in, the way we show etiquette, is very ingrained and is very unconscious. But even if we could, is it desirable that we do so? I mean, it's fascinating. When I visited Manipur, so Manipur is a Gaudiya Vaishnav culture. They're followers of Narottama Das Thakur. But their culture is different than what's generally ISKCON culture. They have their own culture. And Srila Prabhupada very much liked the Manipuri culture. He wanted the Manipuri song and dance to travel the world, and he talked about that Manipur could become the first Vaishnava state, for example. But you go there and you see some of the Manipuri devotees, they've taken on ISKCON culture, at least to a great extent. But many of them have retained their own culture, which is a Gaudiya Vaishnava culture. And is that okay? Are we okay with their maintaining their own way of etiquette, their own way of dealing? I mean, just like in Manipuri culture, the ladies all dress in saffron lungis when they perform their puja. So early in the morning, all of Impal is covered with ladies wearing saffron silk lungis. And then later in the day, they change into something else. So it's quite astonishing, all of these ladies in saffron silk lungis. And there's traveling kirtan parties of ladies that go from temple to temple. And in each temple, the head priest gives them each a donation of money and cloth, and then they have kirtans in the style of Narottama Das Thakur. And these are Gaudiyas. These are not just Vaishnavas, but these are Gaudiyas. They also use the conch shell as a musical instrument in kirtan. And they'll have two conch shells they're playing simultaneously, and they play it as a musical instrument. It's quite astonishing. And their whole history and culture is wrapped up with worship of Krishna. You can't really separate. Like, you know, in America, we have a complete separation between American history and Vaishnava culture. But there, it's totally intertwined. You know, and you go to the palaces of the kings, and they have temples of Radha and Krishna, and they've set up replicas of Shamakund and Radhakund and Govardhan. But their culture is very different. Their food is very different. The way they serve prasadam is quite different. The way they dress is different. And what to speak of a place like Bali. You know, Bali is a Hindu culture, but it's radically different from India. I mean, it's just radically. You know, you think Bali is a Hindu island, you're going to go there and it's going to be India. But it's not. The people are not ethnically, bodily Indians. They're racially different. And their culture, their way of dealing with each other, their dress even. And a big issue in Bali is, can the people who become ISKCON devotees wear their traditional Balinese temple dress? Because in Bali, when you visit a temple, you wear a particular dress. It may not be the dress you wear all the time, but when you visit a temple, you have to wear this particular dress. And for the men, it's a little hat, and it's a kind of lungi with like another sash on top of it. And the ladies wear lace tops, also with a kind of sarong, a kind of lungi. And this is their traditional Hindu dress for visiting a temple. So many of the devotees continue to wear that kind of clothing, but there's a pull. You know, should they do that, or should they all dress in ISKCON dhotis and saris and things like that? And we had, our movement was banned in Indonesia for 15 years because the preachers who went there went in and said, "We're not Hindus." And they didn't realize that as soon as they said that, the government said, "Then you're not allowed to be in this country." So, you know, what are we supposed to do? Are we supposed to get the essence of respect, that you're supposed to show respect to family members, especially when you haven't seen them for a long time, and that's important? Or are we supposed to get the principle and the details? Well, if they're older than you, you touch their feet, and if they're the same age, you embrace them. We just tend to embrace everybody, right? American etiquette is anybody in your, any family member, it doesn't matter. We don't see embrace of a family member as denoting equality. Whereas in the Shastra, embrace is denoting equality. And touching feet or having feet touched is denoting status. Are we supposed to take those sort of details? We might also point out that one cultural difference is whether you have what's called an egalitarian culture or a hierarchical culture. So in egalitarian cultures, it's considered disrespect and bad form to act as if you are superior to anybody else. You know, okay, we know that some people are richer or more famous or whatever, but you're not supposed to act like that. You're supposed to act like everybody's equal. So that's an egalitarian culture. And then in a hierarchical culture, it's very important to establish social status externally, symbolically, by where people sit, by how they address each other, by how they dress, and so forth. And people who come from hierarchical cultures get very uncomfortable in egalitarian cultures because they don't know what people's status is. And people in egalitarian cultures will feel very uncomfortable in hierarchical cultures. Does that make sense to everybody? Mm-hmm. Right? I know that one of the strongest egalitarian cultures in the world is in Australia. And most of the rest of the world considers Australians, therefore, to be very rude because they don't tolerate any exhibition of a higher status. You know, if you do anything that shows that you might have a higher status, they'll immediately push you down. Now, that's not acceptable in our culture. One of the most interesting experiences I had in this regard was when I was in Brazil, which is America's, I think, obviously a very egalitarian culture. But the Brazilians, the Australians, are more egalitarian than the Americans. So I had a very interesting experience there. I was there at the grand opening of a, I don't know if you really call it a temple, there aren't any installed deities there, kind of like a preaching center, right in the middle of the city of Sao Paulo. So we had two grand openings. The first one, we invited all of the ambassadors from all the different embassies in Sao Paulo. And we also invited many of the top religious leaders in the city. So it was a real VIP event. And there was a local sannyasi there, myself. So the sannyasi spoke, and he had a beautiful garland on, and I spoke with an identical beautiful garland on. And then they had one of the VIPs get up and speak, and they gave him a garland. Then they had another VIP get up and speak. Well, there were only four garlands. And I looked at the, I was sitting next to the temple president on his left was a Bengali brahmachari. And I said to the temple president, how many of these VIPs are going to speak? He said, I don't know many of them. And I said, well, Prabhu, there's only four garlands. I said, you cannot give garlands just to two of the VIPs and not to all of them. I said, if you only gave garlands to me and the sannyasi, they would assume it was something just for our society. But if you're going to give to some of the guests, you have to, who are speaking, some of the guest speakers, you have to give to all the guest speakers. And he said, oh, it's all right. Yeah, they'll understand. And the Bengali on the other side of him was having a complete meltdown. Prabhu, 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 this is a Mahaparad. I mean, he was completely losing it. Because he's from a very hierarchical culture. So for him to respect some of the VIPs and not others was a catastrophe. But because he's from a very hierarchical culture, he wasn't going to do anything about it unless the temple president authorized him to. So he was just melting down in his chair. And I was there having about half a meltdown that he was having. And the temple president was like, oh, you know, it's okay. You know, we don't have to have these signs. It's not important. But because I'm an American, I was going to do something without authorization. So I said, well, I'm just going to do something about this. So I got up and walked from behind. I took off my garland and put it back in the box. I recycled it, and I said to the sannyasi, please put your garland in the box. So he did that. That gave us a little bit more time. Then someone had made a really special champak garland for me, which I didn't wear. I said, please put that in the box. Okay, so now we had three garlands in the box. People were speaking just for like 3 or 4 minutes. So then I commandeered all the devotees in the temple, and I said, get me all the flowers. So we got all the flowers out of the cooler, all the flowers that were in the temple. We raided the temple garden, and we picked every single, I mean, seriously, we picked every flower from the temple garden, even the ones that were sort of going bad, you know. And we got every bit of thread we could find and every needle, and everybody who wasn't in the room with the VIPs was furiously making garlands. And we had this one Muslim imam speaking, and he was going on and on and on. And I'm sure the people in the room were thinking, please stop. And I was thinking, don't stop. Anyway, we ended up giving everyone a garland. But at one point, I remember I went behind the speakers with my back to the audience and facing the altar, and I took the vases off the altar so we could use those flowers also. But it was fascinating to me, this difference in culture. I mean, here we had people from, we had, you know, the ambassadors and the diplomats from all these different embassies of the world. You know, there were Koreans there. And, you know, it would have been, instead of a big PR positive event, it would have been a PR negative event. But what is the purpose of this etiquette, whether we take the details or the principles? So the purpose of this etiquette is to train us in worship of God, to train us into entering into God's society. And we find this analogy of the family is there in spiritual life. You know, how to treat your family members. Because we could also make an argument, you know, we could make this first argument that, well, this is some detail that we're not supposed to apply in Washington, D.C. And we could also make the argument, well, what does it matter? Etiquette within the family. We're supposed to be detached from family life. But we find that family has this analogy in spiritual life. We talk about God brothers, God sisters, the guru as father, God as the father, Radha as the mother. Right? Prabhupada said, oh, mother Hara, please engage me in the service of Krishna. Right? Prabhupada would often refer to Srimati Radharani as mother. Now we see devotees as master, ourselves as servants. You know, my dear Prabhu, your servant. Prabhupada says we should see all living entities as our Prabhus, that we're the servants of everyone. Right? Prabhupada says we should chant like the child is crying for a mother. Now, Prabhupada says the men should see the women except for their wives as mothers. The women should see the men except for their husbands as their sons. He said ISKCON should be a family based on love and trust. So we have this, these family analogies. Just Lord Nisingadev's appearance today, and Prahlad Maharaj is described as being like a father to the poor. That to equals he was like a sympathetic brother. To respectable persons he was like a servant. So in trying to understand God and trying to understand our relationship and God with the and the devotees, often we're using these family analogies. So if you don't have proper behavior within the family, those analogies won't work. If you say, cry to Krishna like a child for their mother, and your mother abandoned you when you were 1 year old, you know, or she abused you or something, it's not going to make any sense to you. You know, care for the poor like a father, you know. If you had no father, or you had 10 stepfathers and one of them raped you or whatever, you know, it's not going to make any sense. Or we're all like, ISKCON is like a family, you know. If your family, if everybody was insulting each other and, you know, throwing pots at each other, you say, well, I don't know if I want ISKCON to be like my family. So we have a real problem, and it's increasing in the world. This is not just a Western problem. You know, I'm sorry to say, but it's not just a Western problem. As a traveling preacher, we can say with firm conviction that the breakdown of the family is happening everywhere in the world, some places less than others. In Indonesia, for example, divorce is still very uncommon. But generally in the world, the family is breaking down. People are not getting married. They're just simply not marrying. Either they're cohabiting or whatever. You know, they're not having children. The family's breaking apart. People are not grown up with their biological parents. In a place like China, where there's a one-child policy, there are no brothers and sisters. You know, this is about how you treat your brother. But suppose you're in a society where there's no brother. There are no brothers. What's a brother? Just imagine that. A society where there's no brothers, no sisters, no uncles, no aunts, no cousins. For several generations. Try to imagine that. Like 3-4 generations. No uncles, no aunts, no cousins, no brothers, no sisters. So none of this would make any sense. Oh, we're God brothers. We're God brothers? Huh? What's a brother? What does that mean? So what's the value of a family? I thought I'd just talk briefly. What's the value of family? Because the Shastras seem to mostly put down family, right? Well, first of all, Prabhupada says in the Bhagavad Gita, 18th chapter, that the value of a family is to make your mind peaceful for spiritual life. So just frankly, most people, without going through family life, will not have a peaceful mind. And we've seen it practically. You know, when we used to give sannyas to young people, 80% is the statistic that I got from Jayadorji Swami. fell down. They weren't able to maintain it. They weren't peaceful. So where you make the mind peaceful, okay, I have my own home, I have my own kitchen, I have my own money, I have this member of the opposite sex who hopefully loves me. You know, my husband thinks I'm the most beautiful woman in the world. My wife thinks I'm the most, you know, intelligent man on the planet. And I have these children who adore me, and I'm peaceful. You know, it's like giving the mind some candy. You know, your child's acting up in the supermarket or something, and you want them to be quiet, and you just, you know, get them something. Get them an apple to eat. My son does this. Whenever they go to the supermarket, they take two apples, and they give one to each of their kids. Okay, eat this apple and be quiet. So it's very much like that with the mind. I want this, I want this, I want this, I want this. Okay, here, take your grihastha life and be quiet and let me chant Hare Krishna. And as we said, a family is also the model for the spiritual family. In the spiritual world, Prabhupada says there's no sannyas. There's no sannyasis in Goloka Vrindavan. What are they going to renounce? It's a village with families. Krishna has his mother and father, and he has his brother. Right? In Dwarka, he also has many, many. In Dwarka, Krishna has many, many brothers and sisters. Vasudeva has, 16 wives. He has like 100 brothers and sisters. And people have cousins. And there's a book by Rupa Goswami, the Radhakrishna Ganodesha Deepika, where he gives the names and relationships of so many of the residents of Vrindavan, Mother Yasoda's sisters and her aunts, and right, and Lalita's mother and father. And there's all of these family relationships. And there's we have a little model here. Get some idea. Also, the family is what gives stability to society. Without stable families, society is a mess. This is something that sociologists know very well. Sociologists say as soon as you get to 17% illegitimate children, the whole societal order breaks down. Do you know what we have now in the United States? 40%. 40% children born out of wedlock.
Really?
Yeah. In 1960, it was 4%. We've gone from 4% to 40% in 55 years. Ironically, after putting in place the very things to try to prevent illegitimacy, you know, by making wide-scale birth control and abortion available, the idea was that this was going to stop illegitimate children, but instead the numbers of illegitimate children have increased by 10 times. And as soon as you have the breakup of the family, everything becomes unstable. Crime increases, mental illness increases, you know, lack of education. I mean, we know this. When we study education, we know that your biggest predictor of how well children will do in school is how stable the family is. It's just a known fact. You know, which is why governments all over the world do things to encourage families. They give tax breaks to families, right? They give estate tax breaks. All different facilities are made for families. It's not really meant as a privilege to the people involved. You know, it's not like, well, I'm in love with my pet, you know, can they be my family member and I get a special tax break? That's not what it's for. It's because the stable family is the whole foundation of society. Not only does it give peace to the individual, but peace for society. And imagine if in every family, even in just here in the Washington, D.C. area, if the husbands and wives truly loved each other, if there was respect in every single family in the D.C. area, what would happen? Wouldn't that make a major difference? Just that one thing. If people within the family had respect and fidelity to each other, it would instantly change the whole social fabric. And then it's the basis of good population. So the grihasthas have a duty of charity, and they're supposed to give two kinds of charity, children and money. That's the charity that the grihasthas give. So the grihasthas are the only ones who are allowed to earn money. The brahmacharis are students, the vanaprasthas are retired, the sannyasis are dead. So the only people who have an occupation are the married people. Students, retired, and dead people don't have jobs. And grihastha ashram is the only ashram where you can therefore do your varna, where you can exhibit your psychophysical nature. And I like it where Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, because I wanted to earn money, therefore I took a wife. Not because I have a wife, therefore I earn money. That the understanding is if you want to earn money, you have to at least maintain somebody else. You can't have the money just for yourself. There's always a sacrifice involved. And not only do you have to maintain at least your spouse, But you're supposed to give charity. At least half of what you earn is supposed to be given in charity. And then, okay, you want to enjoy a sexual relationship? Okay, you have to give in charity good children. You can enjoy sex, but it has to be with your spouse for whom you take responsibility. You can't just enjoy sex with anybody or by yourself. And then you have to produce out of that sexual pleasure not only children, but good children. And again, just imagine if all the children that were being produced, even in this one city, if they were being produced in a stable marriage out of love and being trained in God consciousness. I was talking to one devotee who said, she said, until I was 30, I didn't want to have a child because I thought, why bring any children into this world? She said, then I thought, if nobody has good children, how will the world become a better world? The way the world will improve is by good children. And then also family life is the step between the brahmachari ashram and the higher renounced ashrams. The brahmachari ashram is the most dependent ashram. The brahmachari lives strictly under the care of the guru, only eats when he's called, only does what he's told. The brahmachari is a child and is a dependent. The vanaprasthas and sannyasis are independent. The sannyasi is the most independent. And the grihastha ashram is a stepping stone to prepare one for independence and responsibility. And as I said before, the grihastha ashram is the only place where you can do your varna. In the brahmachari ashram, you're being trained for your varna. In the sannyas and vanaprastha ashram, you're only engaging in the 64 angas of bhakti. You're not supposed to be engaging anymore in your occupation. You've retired. That's what it means to retire. You've retired from your occupation. So the grihastha ashram gives facility for people of engaging their psychophysical nature in the service of the Lord. So at least if we take the principle of this etiquette, whether or not we may take up the particular details of this etiquette, we should take up the principle and understand that the principle of having respectful, stable, sane family life is very much part of our service to Krishna. Our heart should be in Krishna's family. We should not be identifying with our material family. But having decent and stable families with proper etiquette is very much a service to Krishna and very much a service to the society of devotees. So, questions, comments? Yes.
You mentioned that brahmacharis, should be trained for their varnas.
Yes.
Very often, and perhaps in ISKCON, you see that the tendency is for brahmacharis really to be trained for sannyas and not really to be prepared for the grihastha ashram.
I don't even see, frankly, that most of our brahmacharis are being trained for sannyas.
Well, they're just being dealt with maybe less sannyas. I mean, and there doesn't seem to be a healthy connect between, I'm going to be a brahmachari, but then to be
I have a radical proposal.
To be able to take care of family properly. You know, I don't think
You're absolutely right. And I have a radical proposal, and it's very radical, although it's totally Vedic, that my own proposal is if we want to bring the brahmachari ashram into the modern world, we should look to the Vedic model, that the brahmachari ashram is for children and teenagers. It's not for adults. It's an educational program. It's a training program. It's not a system of providing cheap labor for temples. And a place for people who don't want to take any responsibility to hang out until their material desires become so overwhelming that they can't do it anymore. That's not a brahmachari ashram. Brahmachari ashram is a school. And Prabhupada says in the second canto, it's meant for teaching the values of life along with specific training for a livelihood. So that we should see our brahmachari ashrams, brahmacharini ashrams, as a school. And Prabhupada said that one should not stay in the brahmachari ashram. He said maximum 24, 25 years. That's the maximum. Some places he says 20. And Prabhupada says that one should marry when one is young, ideally. So I'd like to see that by like the age of 20, that we take to the brahmacharis, okay, you have to now make a choice. You have to, are you preparing for the grihastha ashram or for the sannyas ashram? Actually, in the seventh canto, it says the brahmachari can go directly to the grihastha, vanaprastha, or sannyas ashram. So if they plan to go to the sannyas ashram, then we should move them out of the brahmachari ashram into a vanaprastha ashram. That the vanaprastha ashram trains those brahmacharis who want to take sannyas for the sannyas ashram. And then we have two tracks, a track for training for grahastha and a track for training for vanaprastha. Either way, you start becoming more independent and you start taking more responsibility. The brahmacharis are not taking responsibility. They are children. They are students. And to have our members grow up, that the vanaprastha is a much more independent ashram. So if you're not going to marry, then become a vanaprastha. Start taking up your own preaching projects. As one temple president says, decide what kind of baby you want. You know, do you want a physical baby or do you want a project baby? It says, you know, you need to choose one or the other. You need to take some responsibility. And I'd like to see that we even differentiate, that you graduate from the brahmachari ashram, and even if you want to eventually take sannyas, you're now in the vanaprastha ashram. You're a brahmachari, but who's in the vanaprastha ashram? To give it a different social status, give it some recognition that the standards are going to be somewhat different, the expectations are going to be somewhat different. And I see that if we were to do our brahmachari ashram like this, that our brahmachari ashram would be much more attractive. And then we can say to the brahmacharis, like in any college or university, that this is your college, and when you graduate, you are an alumni. And we expect you as an alumni to give back not just to the movement in general, but to your specific college. So when you get married, we expect you to give a regular monthly donation to the brahmachari ashram that trained you. If you go on to be a vanaprastha and sannyasi, we expect you to give some of the donations you collect back to your brahmacharini ashram. I once asked Mahadudi Prabhu when he was temple president in Soho. I said, if everyone who's ever lived here for at least 6 months were to give £5 a month for the maintenance of the temple, would you have any financial problems? And he said, absolutely not. You know, but we tend to see the brahmachari ashram more as, you know, we're going to take from you. We're going to take service from you. And if people leave, and we want you to stay here as long as possible until you just crack from your material desires. And so when people leave those kind of ashrams, they don't feel that they owe the ashram anything. They feel that if anything, that the movement owes them something. And one brahmachari ashram in the world, which shall remain unnamed, you know, they push the brahmachari, stay as long as possible, which is totally unvedic. And then once they say, I can't take it anymore, I gotta get married, they say, okay, you have 1 month, and then we throw you out. So they haven't given them any training for a livelihood, they haven't given them any training on how to deal with wife and children, and as soon as they announce they want to change ashrams, they have to leave in a month and just figure out for themselves how they're going to survive. And then naturally, those people, first of all, they're going to be very ill-equipped for the grahastha ashram. They're going to really struggle. But, oh, so we told you the grahastha ashram was a dark well full of maya. Ha ha. And nor will they really feel that indebtedness to the society. So this is my radical, ultra-white, right-wing conservative proposal.
The present day of Brahmacharya ashram, we're almost out of time. Like, it's really immense ashram. Really should be training. I like the model, especially to do that for the younger ones, maybe college students.
Yes.
But you know, when we have people want to join, and you know, everybody wants to revive the brahmachari ashram. But it seems to always be like when you're in the brahmachari ashram, you don't think about them. But how does that prepare you for a grihastha? So better that they're immense ashram. And the word's definitions are different.
Well, I can see you have some time in the brahmachari ashram where you don't think about that.
Then you
have to have a choice point where you're preparing, just like in a regular school. You don't think much about your career until you're at least 10 or 12.
Right.
And then you have a choice point where you start preparing actually for your career. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. ISKCON Potomac ki jai.